Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. Find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Tom Barbash, author and contributing book critic for the New York Times and the San Francisco Chronicle, and your moderator for the program. Tonight's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. And now it's my pleasure to introduce today's distinguished speaker, James Ailroy, noted author of such novels as L.A. Confidential and The Black Dahlia, whose new memoir is entitled The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women. James Ailroy has established himself as not only one of the great crime writers of our time, but one of our greatest writers. Time magazine named his novel American Tabloid the best novel of the year in 1995. He's the author of 13 novels, two terrific memoirs, and countless works of journalism. When James Ailroy decides that he's going to be ambitious about his next work, he doesn't just write a great big novel. The rest of us try to do. He writes trilogies and quartets. The L.A. Quartet includes The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential, and White Jazz. His Underworld USA trilogy includes American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Blood's a Rover. For someone who writes so well about murder and death, there is no writer I know who is more alive on the page than James Ailroy. He's so smart at dialogue, at capturing the way Americans think and speak, and he creates such sparks and urgency, fear, and desperate longing in his work. He is a true master and something of a living marvel, and we're very happy to have him here tonight. Please welcome James Ailroy.
Thank you, Mr. Barbash. I am honored to be here in San Francisco. I'm thrilled that you all came out to see me. I realize you had options tonight. You could have stayed home and attended to your sex lives, your drug habits, your fatuous worship of President Barack Obama, and you didn't. You came here to see me, and I'm nothing but grateful.
I want to start with when you were first starting to write novels, while other people might have been in graduate school, you were actually caddying, and you were caddying at golf clubs as you wrote your first five novels, if
yes.
I have that right. What did that give you, that experience, versus, say, a sort of traditional path towards a writing career?
No one told me that I could not write a novel. No one told me that I could not write a novel. I had never read short stories. I don't enjoy short fiction. I have read crime novels almost exclusively. I dislike magical realism. I have not read mainstream American literature, with a very few exceptions. I have read novels written by Americans almost exclusively. I thought for many years that I wanted to be a writer so that I would have a girlfriend, a swanky pad on Rossmore Avenue in L.A., some swinging Ivy League threads, and a groovy sports car. I was gravely mistaken. It was finally when I got the idea to write a story that became my first novel, Brown's Requiem, about a tall, thin, dark-haired, bespectacled man who repossessed cars, who hung out with country club golf caddies, who got involved with a bunch of low-life golf caddies, who's obsessed with the Black Dahlia murder case and had an overweening love of classical music, that I finally realized you can tell your own story and couch it in genre fiction full of shootouts, fistfights, intrigue, societal observation across a wide level. And though you will probably not find a girlfriend while writing this story, the private eye hero will definitely meet a woman who plays the cello. So I wrote the fucking book and I sold it.
In your second book, Clandestine, you actually are in some ways writing about your mother's murder. Is that correct?
Yes.
But in that case, the crime gets solved, I guess, is the difference. You know,
Yes, and my father kills my mother. There is a 9-year-old boy who looks like me when I was 10 years of age. And the woman lawyer resembled a transient girlfriend that I had at the time. It doesn't take a genius to put all of this together.
So in terms of directly writing about yourself or your impetus to actually write My Dark Places, can you tell about the origins of that, moving from fiction into memoir, what the challenges were like, you know, what that first experience? I told you, I guess, before here that I had read an essay that Art Cooper from GQ magazine had been the person who really sort of thought this would be a terrific idea. What was your initial reaction when he suggested it, and had you already thought that eventually you were going to write about this?
I had no idea that I would write my memoir, My Dark Places, about my mother's 1958 murder. A series of events interceded. My ex-wife, Helen Knode, my second ex-wife, bought me a picture of myself in the LA Times archive. It's been over-reproduced many times since. I have been told that my mother was just killed. I'm 10 years old. I'm lost in opportunism, calculation, ambiguous bereavement, and my reporter friend told me that he would be seeing my mother's file as part of a piece he was doing on unsolved San Gabriel Valley homicides. I realized I had to see the file and write about it for GQ magazine. I decided to turn it into a full-length book. I would attempt to solve my mother's investigation with a cop named Bill Stoner, retired LA County Sheriff's homicide detective. We failed to find the killer. The book describes my arc of reconciliation with my mother. There is no conclusion.
You said, and just now as you spoke of sort of the bereavement was ambiguous, and also I saw in another interview that you described glibly using your mother's murder to promote the Black Dahlia. Did it feel glib at the time, or did it only feel glib in retrospect, or does it still feel that? Does it feel like something else? You know, when you say that, is that a form of self-deprecation? And because I'm sure it was a whole bunch of things, but how did it feel at the time?
It felt glib at the time because I had 6 published novels, no hits. I knew this was a hit book. I knew that the doppelganger aspect of my mother's death, Elizabeth Short's death, becoming obsessed with Elizabeth Short's death in the wake of my mother's death, was an exploitable media story. A character in my novel, Blood's a Rover, says, your options are do everything or do nothing. I would rather exploit than do nothing, and I don't find exploit too harsh a verb here. The book honors my mother. The book addresses her as a human being. I was handsomely compensated for writing the book. I tried to find the killer. I failed. It wasn't until years later that I realized that my mother and I comprised not a murder story, but a love story. And it was then that I conceived my current book, The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women, which had has a staggering non sequitur conclusion.
Can you describe, for those who haven't yet read the book, what the title refers to, The Hilliker Curse?
On the occasion of my 10th birthday, in March of 1958, my mother, Jean Hilliker, a 43-year-old alcoholic, registered nurse, divorced from my father for 2.5 years, sat me down half-gassed and said, "Sonny, you're now 10. You can live with your dad or with me. It's your call." I said, "My dad!" She gave me a whack, a big one. I fell off the couch, gouged my head on a glass coffee table. I called my mother a drunk and a whore. She hit me again. She pulled back from it. Christmas 57, I had read a kid's book about spells, curses, and witchcraft. I recalled the book, issued the curse, wished my mother dead. She was murdered coincidentally 3 months later. Thus, the Hilliker curse is a predator's confession, a cri de coeur, an apologia, a redress of the women who have shared my life with me, and it has quite a surprising happy ending that many critics are skeptical of. But if you're skeptical of the ending of the Hilliker curse, there are a couple of reasons for this. You do not believe in deep physical and romantic love. And since I'm a high-class guy and attempting to be higher class, the expressed fuck you all that I would say to critics who dislike the conclusion of this book might backfire in the end.
Do you think also...
But I did say it!
One critic who liked your book referred to it as your most humane and touching book. Are those difficult words for readers to associate with James Ellroy?
No, the books are tender. They're full of passion. They are full of bad men in love with strong women. I come out of romanticism. The single greatest male figure in my life has been Beethoven. He's not a writer. He's a musician. I have conversations with him all the time. They're difficult. He's deaf. I don't speak German, and he doesn't speak English. I make it work anyway.
In fact, Beethoven features several, very prominently in the book. But can you talk about that? Those aspects of Beethoven that reminded you of yourself in some ways, because there are some things that people who don't know about the life of Beethoven wouldn't know. Ways in which you connected to his story and his mode of being.
Beethoven is the greatest artist ever created by civilization. The gap between Beethoven and other great musicians is something equivalent to this. He is a man of almost indescribable courage, because the worse it got, the greater he got. As the cone of silence fell over him with greater and greater totality, he was forced to move inward, to seek God, to recall what he could hear and what he could think, and in the course wrote the greatest music of all time. So, if you're megalomaniacal, and I tend to run that way, what does it cost you to identify with the greatest artist who ever lived? Why not?
I agree. I want to talk about obsessiveness. There's a way in which you described yourself as being effectively obsessive, but are all good novelists necessarily obsessive? Are all good people, or people who perform in the arts at the highest level? Does that take obsession? And can you talk about the channeling of your obsessions, a variety of obsessions that come across in your memoir and in your fiction, and how you use that in your work?
I can't honestly comment on authors or musicians today because I don't watch television or go to movies. I don't have a cell phone or a computer. I live in a cultural vacuum. There's a reason for this. The reason is, the greater the solitude that I achieve, the better I can think, the better I can immerse myself in the historical periods that I write about. And aside from spending time with the woman who forms the conclusion of the Hilliker curse and driving from my pad to her pad, I am largely alone, laying in the dark, thinking, having conversations with either the woman herself, who does speak English and is perfectly capable of hearing everything that I say, and who often talks back to me and, quite frankly, contradicts me a great deal, or conversations with Beethoven, who just tends to sit there and glower. And I love to think. I love to plot. I love to plan. I believe that art is consciousness. I believe that if an artist of decent intelligence, native talent, thinks, plots diligently, meticulously, and with great exactitude, he or she can get better, 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 and better. I plot and plan a great deal. My preceding novel, Blood's a Rover, is a 14-page outline. The outline is detailed down to the most minute dot on the I and cross on the T. It is all the action for the ultimate 676-page text laid out in minute detail. There are people who will tell you that, oh, my characters do things that I don't intend for them to do. That is, of course, disingenuous bullshit. What happens is, if you write off the top of your head, sooner or later, you are presented with dramatic options, and since these characters don't exist outside of the page and your head, you are presented with dramatic options, and you take one or the other, and that determines the future course of the book. Having a superstructure for gigantic, densely plotted novels this big allows me to live in extrapolation, in improvisation, because the dramatic superstructure is inviolate. I firmly believe that if an author attacks consciousness, holds it as their single greatest spiritual attribute, that they can get better and better and better and better. I do not want to be a writer writing thinner and thinner and thinner books, hoping for the Nobel Prize. I'm never going to win the Nobel Prize or the National Book Award or the Pulitzer Prize. I'm earning a dandy living writing great books. God knows how hard I try. The people closest to me know how hard I try. I'm nothing but happy to be here. I love to fight. I hate to lose. I don't care if I get hurt. And I never give up. And I will not falter at the pursuit of writing fiction and memoir because Jesus Christ died for each and every one of us, because Luther slew the papal beast at Wittenberg, And because Beethoven wrote the greatest music of all time, stone deaf, so who are we to falter?
We talked earlier about your process, the long sort of process of outlining your novels. And I want to actually talk about, I guess I'll start with that in transitions in your career. You said that reading Don DeLillo's Libra had a big effect on you.
Yes.
So that the transition from writing the sort of psycho noir thrillers, you know, in the beginning, you know, sort of moving into something that's larger and more political. Can you talk about the process as you sort of opened up your books and they began to contain more of the world, when that happened and how that happened?
May I first state that I don't write noir. I write historical novels set in L.A., the film noir epicenter, at the height of the film noir era, and had not watched much film noir until after I had written the L.A. Quartet and was chiefly interested in seeing the physical locales of the books that I had just written. I read Libra when it was published in 1988. It's the story of John F. Kennedy's assassination, largely told through the eyes of Lee Harvey Oswald. I saw that this book was sui generis, that it was wildly deep, that he had created in DeLillo a character of staggering complexity and utter fatuousness, and that I could not do that because DeLillo got there first. But I saw that DeLillo posited a wonderful thesis as to who whacked JFK. Crazy renegade CIA guys, not the CIA as an entity, crazy right-wing Cuban exiles, and the mob. I went out, read some JFK assassination theory books, saw that he had cherry-picked the best historical characters, the most realistic historical perspective, and I began to see that I could write a physically much larger book that kept Lee Harvey Oswald off stage, and that the harbingers of the assassination started to percolate when Fidel Castro took over Cuba on New Year's Day, 1959. Then geopolitics came to me in a nutshell, and I followed up with my big novel on the 60s, The Cold 6000, and my ultimate fictional masterpiece, 68 to 72, Bloods Are Over.
What was your reaction at the time, or do you remember your reactions to the assassinations? Were those large moments in when they occurred, at the time they occurred, were they very vivid?
When JFK got it?
When JFK, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, you know, all the assassinations of the 60s, how were those
intense experiences? No, I was a Republican, and I was hoping Barry Goldwater would be elected in 1964, and I was a fatuous kid, so I didn't think much of anything. Yeah, I wanted to go to a movie that night. All the movie theaters were closed.
I was wondering if you could talk now about the difference. You talked about the fact that those people who say that your characters are not going to have a life of their own, is that difference when you're writing your memoir? When you're writing the novels, you have research staff, you have all the interviews that you conduct. Uh-huh. How in, you know, and maybe even to talk about the difference between writing the first memoir and this second memoir, the follow-up with the Hilliker Curse, if you could just describe the difference of memoir writing and novel writing.
I had written 11 novels at the time I wrote My Dark Places. It is a memoir that only a journeyman crime novelist could have written. It's a murder story that describes an arc of reconciliation with my mother. A bunch of events had to intercede after that. My second marriage went in the tank. I had some misaligned relationships with women preceding the happy ending relationship that informs the conclusion of the Hilliker Curse. And I began to see that it was the major journey of my life and that it was a shorter book rather than a longer book and a historical essay as much as it was a memoir. I have to be truthful. I am allowed to describe my life physically and my mental life as a younger person as long as I don't lie, yet concurrently, I am allowed to comment editorially as an older man. There is a then and now motif. Then is immediate. It's direct. It's to the point. It's very detailed. But as I go, I can attribute meaning. And that's a gas.
One thing you said in the Hilliker curse, you say, I was tracing the arc of the Hilliker curse. I wanted all women or one woman to be her. And then I was wondering if you could talk about how the image of your mother manifested itself in other women you've either wrote about or loved.
Jean Hilliker was a powerful woman of her era, promiscuous by the fatuous standards of 1958, a registered nurse, a single mother, a hard-charging, good-looking, red-haired alcoholic, stern, a religious woman. She gave me the gift of faith, for which I am forever thankful. And I often, as a child, studied her face. And I have often studied the faces of women for signs of probity, moral character, humor, and strength. There she is. We are separated by 52 years. I will not see her again on this earth. I will be reunited with her in the next earth. I look forward to that. I have not the slightest doubt that it will occur. I think we will have a lot to talk about. That the woman I ultimately ended up with is in many ways complementary to Jean Hilliker and entirely unfathomable and inexplicable, especially when compared to Jean Hilliker, is inexplicable and unfathomable as Beethoven's Ninth Symphony and the late string quartets is nothing but a godsend. And of course it had to happen this way because the male self-will is very often self-serving and quite often self-destructive.
I was wondering, you know, also along with this, you still live in Los Angeles, is that correct?
I spent 25 years away and came back.
And you, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about Los Angeles, what it was like to grow up there, what it's like to live there now. It's featured so heavily and intensely in so much of your work. What your, you know, what your sense of that city has been, both to live in it and to write about it.
I'm from L.A. I grew up there. I don't know as much about L.A. history as you might think I do. I make most of this shit up. It's historically valid as far as it's historically valid. I think that each and every one of you who grew up somewhere might be similarly and similarly inchoately obsessed with your own hometown. I just got lucky that my parents hatched me in a cool locale. I live in L.A. because it's where I always go when women divorce me. And I got very lucky that my romantic fate awaited me there. I have no sense of L.A. today. It's overcrowded. It's smoggy. There are far too many people with far too many automobiles. I can't wait to get out. Sooner or later, we will.
In terms of, we're going to move to the audience's questions in just a second, but in terms of the, your trajectory as a writer, now that, that you've accomplished, you've written these great big books that are so politically relevant, and I'm wondering what you do as a, or what the difference is now as a writer in his 60s, later on in his career. what your next projects are going to be and how different it is now at this point with all the success you've had to write as opposed to when you were young and caddying at the golf club and just trying to get some books out and make a name for yourself. How is it different now to be where you are in your career?
Well, I'm living high on the hog. I drive a swanky automobile. I got the pad on Rossmore I've always wanted, the woman I've always wanted. We stay in swank hotel suites. I am determined to die broke. I love being compensated in a big way for the books that I write. I'd write them for free. I'm a good Lutheran boy, have always been. I do it for free. I have to do it, and it's a big, fat fucking blast. The next quartet of books I write, which will dwarf everything that I've written to date, will be the second L.A. quartet. It will take characters from the first L.A. quartet, The Black Dahlia, The Big Nowhere, L.A. Confidential and White Jazz, The Underworld USA Trilogy, American Tabloid, The Cold 6000, and Bloods Are Over, and place them in L.A. the month of Pearl Harbor, December 1941. They're going to be big books.
Have you started in on them?
Yes.
On more than one of them or just the first? So you only work at one thing at a time, is that correct?
Yes.
All right, well, let's ask a couple questions from the audience. Who would win in a spare go fight, Big Pete or Bad White? Bud White.
What fight?
Square go? Yeah. Okay, that's missing one letter.
What, Iron Cage? Big Pete. Let's get the tone up, folks.
Did your time in San Francisco change your political tendencies?
Yes, I got more right wing.
Can you tell your Nick Nolte story?
What, Nick Nolte? Yes. Nick Nolte lets his dogs urinate and defecate with abandon over four of the five houses on his property in Zuma Beach. And I like Nick Nolte very much. I love dogs very much, but I do not let them urinate and defecate with impunity in my apartment or the apartment nearby that I spend most of my time in. In fact, the woman I love has something called the litter robot. She has a cat whose name is Bennett. And Bennett is coincidentally named after a demonic robbery cop named Scotty Bennett in my last book, Bloods Are Over. This astonishing thing allows Bennett to crawl in there, drop his load, exit, and then 7 minutes later, the robot kicks in and spins the shit around and deposits it in a plastic bag. And these fucking things are only $300. What a fucking deal.
On another topic. You've answered this a little bit, but how do you prepare when writing your novels? You just said that you use outlines, but maybe you could talk about a little bit of the research process. You mentioned a little bit, but to go into more detail of how you get so much exacting detail in your big books.
First of all, I make most of this shit up. Secondly, American history and LA history have been very, very kind to me. Third, I know a woman named Kateri Butler who researches for me. You will never catch me going to the third world. Kateri has been to Vietnam. She has been to the Dominican Republic. She looked over the Plaine du Massacre into Haiti. She came back with a great many notes. She showed me slides. I felt like I'd been there. I made the rest of it up. History is kind to me. I got very, very lucky on Blood's a Rover because the 1965 Civil War in the Dominican Republic had concluded under Lyndon Johnson's flag, and there wasn't much of a Nixon administration policy going on. So my malefactors had free run to go crazy, and I didn't have to contradict history in any way in that book. From that point on, I take notes, I plot, I plan, I give up time, I lay in the dark, I think.
Question is, are you pleased with the way your work has translated, been translated into movies, from the page to the movie screen?
Money is the gift that no one ever returns. The size, large, always fits. And the color, green, is always flattering. I have been handsomely compensated for the motion picture option rights to numerous of my books. Raise your hand if you're in the audience, you've already finished a bunch of work, and a movie maker who you know in your heart to be a fast buck bullshit artist wants to write you a check for $25,000. There you go. You took it, didn't you? Yes. Now, chances are it has been said that the optioned book to the superbly realized hit movie is what the first kiss is to the 50th monogamous anniversary. Many called, few chosen. There are some movies you want to see, like L.A. Confidential, some movies you want to flee, like The Black Dahlia. They all sell books. It would be ungrateful of me to criticize these films if they were bad for attribution, because nobody forced me to take the dough. I'm nothing but happy.
I read a story, I think, that you described being in Kansas or Kansas City, where there were a bunch of women who told they were so happy to have met the author of the movie L.A. Confidential. And then you suggested that they go buy the book, I guess. Do you recall this?
An elderly woman walked up to me in a video store in Prairie Village, Kansas. And she said, oh, you wrote L.A. Confidential. What a wonderful movie. I just love that movie. Russell Crowe and Guy Pearce were so handsome. And Kim Basinger was so beautiful. And is Kevin Spacey really gay? And I said, you know, Granny, you really loved the movie, didn't you? Oh, yes, I just love the movie. And I said, did you ever read the book? And she said, well, no, I didn't. And I said, then what the fuck good are you to me?
Another question. Did it help with the grief over losing your mother to write about crime and criminals? Someone asked.
Grief? I've already described my bereavement pertaining to my mother's death as ambiguous. I was more than anything else relieved when she was killed. Yes, I buried grief. Yes, it has existed in me for many, many years. But I got to live with my permissive dad. It's come out of my pores again and again and again. There she is, there I am. She mediates my relationships with women in her utter power. I have met in my lifetime one woman who has served to be something so inexplicable, unfathomable, deeply human that she has superseded my mother as a mediating force. A character based on a woman that I was briefly with, a misaligned relationship here in San Francisco. I attribute to her, she never said it in real life, it's in my previous novel, Blood's a Rover, your options are do everything or do nothing. I have decided to write about my mother, explore my mother, dissect my mother's life, analyze my mother every chance I get.
In terms of one thing that when you, it's another thing that I was reading when you, and also because I've heard you read before, your love of dialogue, but specifically the sort of vulgarity in dialogue, and also just, I guess there's nothing timid about you, both as a writer and as a person, and whether that's a hedge, whether you deliberately do that as a sort of a hedge against timidity, to sort of use strong language at times, you know, to employ it both in person and otherwise, and whether that is the way you think normally, or if it, there's a performance mode to that, but where, you know, the tendency to be blunt, to tell things, to talk in a way that people delight in, you know, because it's so fresh and seems, you know, extremely honest. You know, if you could talk about that aspect of that mode of communication, I guess, which is distinctly you.
I'm not a timid person. I'm a very fearful person. I'm a short-tempered person. I've been violent at various times in my life. I'm an assertive person. I'm a sensitive person. And I love to perform. I come from a long line of Protestant clergy. I have often thought that were I not called to writing crime fiction, I would become a Lutheran minister. It has been pointed out by someone in this room that I would be a very, very bad Lutheran minister, and in fact might be one of those Lutheran ministers who go crazy in the Midwest and start robbing banks because they're spending all their money on 900 sex phone calls. I might also add that Martin Luther created the Protestant Reformation because he wanted a woman, and so he found a nun named Katie von Bora, and they had 5 kids.
Because the book, The Hilliker Curse, and it's a terrific book, by the way, because the ending is as happy as it is, because actually it does end with a kind of reconciliation and with a sense that you've found the love of your life. Whether you're, I think a lot of writers have talked about how difficult it is to write about either happiness or love, to talk about that as a challenge. And the other thing is, I wonder if a sort of acute pain is a driving force for you, whether you've ever worried that if you were actually genuinely happy, that it'd be harder to write.
I am happy. I'm a happy guy. I like to kick ass. I've been kicking the shit out of the world for 40 years. I like to engage with people. I get a kick out of people in my disengaged way. And I don't think I've ever had a depressed moment in my life. Insomnia, fear, rage, anxiety, apprehension, anticipation, yes. I am not afraid of happiness. I am afraid of not being happy. I think that the great love of my life will only make me, as she herself said this morning, a greater writer, a better writer, because I will have a richer, deeper view of humanity and be able to describe a greater diversity of character and motive.
A writer friend of mine was talking to an audience recently, and he said that you have to have a certain amount of happiness, and maybe you would agree with this, in order to describe unhappiness. The people that are profoundly unhappy are the ones who are most afraid of writing about unhappiness to a certain extent. So to have a certain level of feeling okay about yourself allows you. I mean, one of the things also is that you describe you have a life in which you cut yourself off from those aspects you insulate yourself. You create a kind of hermetic life in order to create the kind of volume that you create on the page. Can you talk a little bit about that? I mean, I guess expound on that idea of cutting yourself off from the culture. How social are you as a person when you're in the midst of writing a novel?
Part of the civil contract that exists, and you know, let's cut the shit here. The woman's name is Erica Schickel, and she's the dedicatee of this book, and everyone will figure it out. And I have been disingenuous, although I have been avid in my eye contact up to this point. And anyone with eyes has figured this one out. Let's put all of that aside. Repeat the question again. Discussing Ms. Schickel, I tend to digress.
It was a very convoluted question. But I'm interested in the idea of creating a kind of place for yourself in which you can write. There's a quote from Flaubert that said, lead a tranquil life so the storms happen in your work. And there's an aspect of that for you to sort of to cut yourself off from distractions, you know, in order to create something that's so vivid. For you to create the circumstances that allows you to create this kind of vivid world. Is the cutting oneself off from internet, from 24-hour news, is that's part of it, I suppose.
I was in the hotel this morning. I was having breakfast. I heard people talking at the next table. I found it head-scratching. Someone said a black guy was elected president of the United States. It's a joke, motherfuckers. Laugh! I cut myself off because I fear distraction. I live in salutary silence. If I'm not with Ms. Schickel, I have a very, very few other friends. I have no family. I have close friends who are also colleagues. I don't read much. I watch television occasionally. Ms. Schickel got me hooked on the entire run of the Deadwood television show, which is quite a mixed bag in that it's grievously flawed. I find a lot of the dramatic decisions utterly erroneous, but it is one thing. It is love of language, and it is Shakespeare crossed with Dashiell Hammett. And when it's on, oh my God, is it on. And it is nothing. Even though women get very, very short shrift in this television show, but a reduced version of my greatest theme, which is bad men in love with strong women.
Question from the audience has to do with your style of writing. And he said it's praise for being very brief, short, staccato. What's the reason for your prose style?
I like a story wherein every word furthers plot, characterization, milieu. It's also a very male language. And it is the language of police officers who go from one task to the next, trying to solve crimes because their internal lives are disordered. The best police detectives that I know are men and increasingly women who have disordered personal lives. Thus, they need to impose moral order on external events to make them feel happy, feel evolved, feel like they've accomplished something.
Do you think there's something akin, or I was thinking about the friendships that you've had with police detectives and police officers,
right,
to the job of a writer and the job of a detective,
yes,
to a cop?
One of my great bonds with police officers, and I am very, very good friends with a lot of detectives and other officers on the Los Angeles Police Department. Parenthetically, I do not in any way view the LAPD to be anything less than the most magnificent police agency in America. I do not in any way believe the common liberal myth that the LAPD is a fascist, oppressive force. These are the best men and women as a group of people that I have ever met. The basis for my relationship with the Los Angeles Police Department is tripartite. Joseph Wambaugh wrote about it, a former policeman, in the early 1970s. I took note. I was deeply ashamed of the crimes that I had committed, virtually all of them minor. I knew I was wrong. I knew that crime at its base has nothing to do with poverty or racism. It is individual moral default on an epidemic scale. And why do I really love cops? Because they are the only group of men who hate men who fuck over women and children as much as I do.
Well said. And are you something of a hero within the L.A. Police Department?
Yes! I give a good speech.
And maybe we have time for one more question. Well, is it right? And we'll probably have to wrap up soon. The question is, how do the people you mention in your memoir feel about having so many of their intimate moments shared with you, exposed to the public? And I guess in either one.
The heroine of this book is thrilled. My second ex-wife, the only other woman I mentioned by name, has not read it, but her friends say, Helen, you look good. He looks bad. He fucked it all up. Not you. He took the heat. I don't use any of the other women's surnames, and I take the blame. Because I deserved it.
I was wondering also, because the memoirs are such an exploration of your relationship with your mother, living with her memory and with the horror of what happened to her, of your relationship with your father as you've written these books, your sort of sense of him, your sense of yourself either in him, and even maybe your friendships with men, whether they're affected by anything that had to do with your father's relationship to you.
Beethoven is much more important than my father. Here are some things you need to know about my dad. My dad had a 16-inch Fonz. I swear this is not a kid's whacked-out recreation. All his friends talked about it. My dad did not know what country he was born in. He was either born in Boston or over in Scotland. His people came over when he was quite young. They died in a fire. He never knew. He grew up in an orphanage. Think about not knowing what country you came from. It might fuck you up. This was my dad. He was a scratch golfer. He told me once when I was 11, hey, kid, he was from Boston, I poured the pork to Rita Hayworth. I said, Dad, fuck you. We talked that way. You did not slip the schnitzel to Rita Hayworth. Yeah, I fucked her. Yeah. I arranged her wedding to Ali Khan in Paris in 49 when you were one. He died in 65, burned out. I looked up his name in a Hayworth biography 10 years later. Yeah, he was her business manager. Did he, in fact, pour Rita the pork? Beats me? I hope so. This was my dad, brilliant mathematician, knew physics, knew trigonometry, knew a lot of shit. Completely unambitious. The pastor at my church called him the world's laziest white man, and he was not wrong. My dad in a nutshell. Hey, Dad, I saw a penguin at the zoo today. Yeah? I'm a penguin fucker from way back. That's my dad. He was a penguin fucker from way back. That's why I write about my mom. Aside from the fact that she was a woman.
What were the first books you read as a kid? And did your parents encourage you to read?
My dad taught me to read when I was 3 1/2. I don't recall the first books that I read. My dad knew that I couldn't stand to see animals mistreated, hurt, killed on the page, so I quickly graduated to more adult books. My favorite writers as a kid were Mickey Spillane, the king of the anti-communist thriller, and my favorite mainstream writers were the great novelists, neither one a Nobel laureate, Harold Robbins and Irving Wallace. Those motherfuckers could write. Read The Carpetbaggers or The Chapman Report. That is some racy shit.
I think some people that know that you write about crime as much as you do would assume that Chandler was an influence, and I know he was not. Can you talk about... and I think in some ways, I read somewhere that you were not at all drawn to the work of Chandler.
I thought Raymond Chandler was full of shit. I think Dashiell Hammett and James M. Cain were the men. In a nutshell, Chandler wrote the kind of guy that he wanted to be. Isolated, alcoholic, noble, suffused with regret that he never found the woman, whiny, cheaply satirical, given to bad metaphor and simile. He couldn't plot for shit. Hammett wrote the kind of man that he was afraid that he was. He was a Pinkerton strikebreaker, had predatory relationships with women, all of whom were stronger willed than him. Hammett before Chandler, always. And Cain, in Cain's brief novels of murder, Double Indemnity, The Postman Always Rings Twice, Cain's greatest work of fiction, Matriarchal Noir, Mildred Pierce.
When you, in those early days when you were reading these books, were you reading them just to enjoy them, or were you thinking about your own sort of mode of storytelling? I mean, were you thinking about becoming a writer? And then the other question, I guess, as I'm asking this, were you a storyteller as a kid, just a natural one? When people got together, were you good at sort of sitting people down and telling them what happened?
I've already mentioned that I come from clergy stock. I am born to the lectern and the podium. Oh, boy, do not give me a kilt and a clerical collar. I will not let you out of the room, sans salvation. Put that aside. I used to give oral book reports on books that I did not read and, in fact, invented extemporaneously. That was the genesis of whatever gifts I have as a public speaker.
You're a self-described right-winger, you said, which makes you an anomaly in the world of writers. I guess it's kind of hard to find very many Republicans at all amongst mm-hmm. writers. Yes. And just how why do you think that is, incidentally? And why are such a...
People are afraid of appearing inhumane. That's what I think it is. People are afraid to say, I believe in God. I'm theocratic. I believe that God's law rules the world and that it is more important than secular freedom. People are afraid to say, I believe in capitalism. People are afraid to say that I firmly believe that America must rule the world.
And those are your beliefs?
Those are my beliefs.
Okay. And you think others share it, but they're just afraid to actually state it?
I think many people share it. Few, outside of right-wing pundits, or afraid to voice it. But it comes down to this. I don't care what people think about me. I have a wonderful readership. People either agree with me or they don't. It's okay. I like folks just fine. And as far as critics go, I like them to the extent that they like me, hate them to the extent that they hate me, although I tend not to indulge hatred. It's a negative emotion. Dismiss me to the extent that they dismiss me. I do not review books. I do not engage in literary feuds because people work hard to write books. I'm a very exacting critic, and I don't want to shit on anyone.
How's your relationships been with editors over the years, and do you welcome their input, you know, in the process?
I welcome the editor, Sonny Mehta, who is the boss of Alfred A. Knopf, my publisher. Biggest thrill in my career is to be published by Alfred A. Knopf, home of the Borzoi. Huh? An effete dog, not a pit bull, not the dog I would have chosen, but Selah Garrett wasn't my call.
Does he offer a lot of input as you write? Or you...
No, because I write so damn concisely and with such precision. Mm-hmm. He thinks that a lot of my jokes fall flat, and when I start laughing like a hyena over some line that I've dropped, he looks at me. He's a very elegant Indian man, and he looks at me over his glasses and says, "James, it's not as amusing as you think."
Are you apt to talk a lot about your projects before you write? Are you someone who's superstitious that thinks if you talk it out, it's going to be difficult to write?
I'm writing the second LA Quartet. I'll be back at the Commonwealth Club with you, Tom Barbash, when the first book is published.
But you don't go into greater detail about things other than
Ms. Schickel and I will discuss the work.
Okay. This has any more narrations of film noir DVDs planned?
Eddie Muller, my friend and colleague over there, often do DVD commentary for movies like Crime Wave. Wonderful film noir with Sterling Hayden. It's my favorite cop performance of all time. The long form, 164-minute version of Zodiac, has some funny shit in there recited by me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And Les, I was just wondering about if you could describe the moment, I guess, well, I'm thinking specifically about the enormous success of L.A. Confidential, but when you were transformed from sort of a working writer into sort of a household name, whether that was a difficult transition in any way, whether it was just pure fun because now, I mean, I guess with the success of the books, but was there any downside or negative side to becoming a success who made a lot of money and became a celebrity?
May I say that the badly received movie The Black Dahlia sold more books for me in 7 weeks than L.A. Confidential, the wonderfully received movie, did in 12 years. Put that aside. I paid my alimony for 2 years. Huh? I am nothing but grateful. And so it has come to me, all of this, gradually, and I am a good Lutheran boy. I'm always talking to God. I have a very few friends. I lay in the dark and think a lot. I have never gotten to the point where I think, truly, Elroy, you are the king. Truly. No writer, Tolstoy, Shakespeare, name it. You're even greater. I've never had that moment. It's come here, 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 and here. And in the meantime, I'm always planning the work. I'm always working. I'm always proofing pages. I'm always thinking about the next thing. I live there. And that is the way that a writer gets better and better and better and better. It is through this conscious cultivation of consciousness. What I tell, and I often talk to school kids, inner city kids, and I ask for a show of hands. Do you like to be alone in the dark doing nothing? If not, can you spend some time alone in the dark, doing nothing, feeling your greatness? There is the title of a novel that I've never read by Anthony Burgess. It's a thriller. Here it is, The Tremor of Intent. I am obsessed with this phrase because I live in the tremor of intent. I am going to do this. One of the key moments in my career, 1985, I'm a kid writer living back in New York. I was writing The Black Dahlia. L.A. Confidential, an enormous novel, came to me in big chunks, just like that. And it occurred to me, whatever I can conceive, I can execute. Hence, the tremor of intent.
That's great. There's a question. Give us a Noir City Film Fest story if you have one.
I have known Eddie Muller, head of Noir City Film Fest. I can't think of one. Come up with something a little bit more general. Then to close this off, I was going to ask someone to ask me why I write.
Well, I'd like to ask you why you write.
Anyone else? I can only tell you why I write.
Why do people read you?
I can't even tell you that, because the books are so fucking good. Here's why I write. In my art or sullen craft, exercised in the still night, when only the moon rages and the lovers lie abed with all their griefs in their arms, I labor by singing light, not for the strut and trade of charms upon the ivory stages, but for the common wages of their most secret heart. Not for the proud man apart do I write on these spindrift pages, but for the lovers, their arms round the griefs of the ages, who pay no praise or wages, nor heed my art or craft. Dylan Thomas. Thank you. God bless you.
Our thanks to James Ellroy, novelist, whose newest work is a memoir entitled The Hilliker Curse, My Pursuit of Women. We also thank our audiences here on the radio and the internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's Good Lit series, underwritten by the Bernard Osher Foundation. I'm Tom Barbash, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.